Today, the end game is censorship. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and property news. Well, yesterday we had a live show with Robbie Barwick and John Adams, and we went through in some detail the latest on the misinformation and disinformation bill, which is currently passing through the Parliament. And of course, the Senate inquiry ran a live session last Friday where they heard from a number of witnesses. And that is available actually on YouTube. I'll put the links below. We also know now that 15,000 plus submissions were made. And so far, the committee is posting those from organisations rather than individuals. But 15,000 is an amazing response. Now, what I want to do today is to highlight a couple of the witnesses and the information that they set out before the committee. And there were four themes that came through. The first was that the mainstream media are very much trying to differentiate themselves from social media and individuals and are claiming that they are somehow very different. I doubt that, actually. The second point is that the whole issue of fact checking and who does the fact checking is, well, littered with problems, not least because the fact checkers, of course, come from organizations who receive donations or indeed who are paid. And the fact checkers that the social media channels use are also suspect. In recent times, for example, through COVID, we know that both individuals and organizations had posts taken down, sometimes automatically, sometimes not. And in fact, I was hit with some of those. What I was doing was mentioning COVID in the first place. The third point is that the idea that somehow the universities and politicians and mainstream media should be separated and given exclusive access to say what they want, whereas everybody else is not, is of course questionable. And it came out quite clearly that individuals who make shows on YouTube could potentially be disenfranchised. It's worth highlighting, I think, here that social media companies, with the threat of significant fines, will be aggressive and proactive and take people down and shadow ban or absolutely ban posts on particular subjects. Bearing in mind, of course, that the scope of the bill includes discussion about economics and the financial system. That puts a bit of a hole in my ability to make my shows or indeed on the interest of the people to talk about what the politicians are doing. But the final point that came up quite often through the hearings on Friday was that this all amounts to censorship. Censorship of ideas, censorship of people, and of course, who sets the agenda? Who allows information to pass? Well, the government. And I, for one, don't think they have a particularly good track record in not misinforming us about issues and quite often steering the conversation to their own ends rather than to the interests of the people. Anyway, what I want to do now is to play you a series of clips. And we're going to start with the issue of censorship from the IPA.
Daniel Weil, Deputy Executive Director of the Institute of Public Affairs.
Morgan Begg, Director of Research at the Institute of Public Affairs.
Thank you.
You may have heard just at the end of that, my fear is overcompliance. There is zero cost for these platforms under this bill. Significant fines if they go close, therefore it's easier to overcomply and cost nothing. What do you think effect that may have on freedom of speech and freedom of expression?
Well, thanks, Senator. It will have a big censorship effect. As you rightly say, there's a big fine. I think it's 5% of global revenue that the social media companies will be subject to if they fail to comply with the ACMA's directions or definition of misinformation and what is false. So clearly there's going to be a censor first, ask questions later approach that could be taken. The other point, just to, I know this point's been made, but just to build on that, which is we also have a concern about this becoming like a global standard that could be set from Australia, because as you know, these are global platforms. So what tends to happen is they will standardise their compliance regimes across around the world, quite potentially. So there is a concern that this is not just a censorship regime for Australians, but it could then metastasise into a global censorship regime as well, which is, I think, a big concern and something also worth taking into consideration.
Okay. Previous speaker, we raised again the very defined big tech platforms of misinformation and disinformation and the differences they have on a tech platform. This bill opens those up. They're a much broader definition of mis and dis in this. What do you think that effect has on the bill versus the real harms of disinformation?
So it's pretty vague and subjective, and that's one of the main reservations that we have, that misinformation and disinformation themselves are very broad terms. So you look at the concept of harm, causing the potential to cause harm to a range of factors, including, you know, the Australian economy and so forth. It's hard to think of any politically contested issue that could not be conceivably captured under these laws. And that's a real concern of ours. I mean, you know, as we know in our society, people can, you know, take offence or claim that they've been harmed by something. And they may genuinely mean that. They may genuinely feel harmed by someone's speech. But that is an incredibly low threshold by which to police what people can say online. And then we also know the prospect of activists that will weaponise this to try and shut down debate by claiming that something has been harmed, and then they use that to weaponise, which then has a chilling effect where people will just say, well, look, I'm not even going to engage anymore because I'm worried that I'm going to get censored under this regime. One of the foundational views we have is whatever laws are on the books, everybody should be subject to them in the same exact same way.
When we're going down this path, previous speaker again talked about their three big fact checkers, yep, three groups and the panels. Doesn't anything like this put an inordinate amount of faith in three groups that have very little transparency in themselves and accountability to the Australian public?
Yeah, it does, Senator. Look, we've got big reservations about the fact checking component. So clauses 34 and 44 specifically mention the role of fact checking organisations. Now, these are biased organisations, and we've undertaken analysis during the Voice debate, and we analysed 187 fact-checking articles that related to the Voice, published between 22nd of May and of 2022 and 14th of October 2023. So 91% of those claims that were assessed were opponents of the Voice. Only 9% were assessed by proponents of the Voice. So it was a stacked deck throughout that referendum campaign. You know, and unfortunately, these fact-checking organisations have proved themselves to be undertaking, you know, heavily politically biased, with the aim of diminishing a particular case rather than actually undertaking genuine fact-checking. And for those fact-checking organisations to then be emboldened under these laws is something that, you know, it's such a bad bill, it's hard to say it's the worst part, but it's one of the components of it that I think has been under-commented upon, but, you know, very concerning.
Okay. So is there anything in this bill that would prevent a person outside of government, outside of big tech, from taking action to prevent over-complying? If I hold reasonable beliefs, if I hold these views true, I think they're... I'm not trying to do disinformation, which I think is different.
Yep.
If I'm out there with a true belief, the earth is flat, I post this stuff, it gets taken down, is there any protection for me? Is there any way, anything for big companies where I'm not over-censored?
Don't believe so.
No, there's no material substantive provision in the bill which would have the effect of inducing a social media platform to limit their moderation or their censorship policies under this bill.
And there's no definition of the serious harm across... It can be a person receiving serious harm, not just an organisation like The Economy or something like this. So if, you know, a person's strong belief in anything can be offended to a harm level if I say something against it. Isn't that true, Innes?
I believe so.
Yeah, OK. Yeah. And so, last question, Chair. In summary of this, I'm reading from the questions I asked. We have a bill that empowers a small group of people as fact-checkers to exclude an elite few from this argument that will tend towards over-censorship and over-production of instance with no recourse. Is that how Am I reading it wrong?
That's right. Plus, there's also the prospect of imprisonment under this. Jail for lack of compliance as well. If you can...
Yeah. So, you know, one of the... This whole apparatus that's being set up also encompasses the ACMA's extraordinary investigative powers. So under the Broadcasting Services Act, sections 170 and 171, they have these immense information gathering and investigation powers. And of course, the misinformation and the purpose of those investigative powers is for the due administration of the Broadcasting Services Act. Well, the misinformation provisions are going to be added to that act. So all of those investigative powers and the power to hold hearings and launch investigations will then encompass the administration and the compliance of the digital platforms with the Act.
Okay. Can I just quickly on that point, those investigative powers, those information gathering powers, are they limited to corporate organisations, if you like, that are subject to the Broadcasting Services Act, or can ACMA go to an everyday Australian and demand information, subpoena them to come and appear at a hearing, etc.?
No, good question. So the division in the Broadcasting Services Act is quite broad. The powers can be used against any person, and it's really up at the discretion of ACMA if that person is of interest to their investigation.
To take an example here that might be relevant in this situation, if an investigation is launched into suspected misinformation, ACMA could go to an everyday Australian who may have posted something online and demand that they provide information, that they appear at some kind of star chamber to answer questions with the threat of jail time, ultimately. If they
Exactly. So, you know, you could have a YouTube channel that, you know, gets, you know, a moderate amount of views, but you might find yourself the target of this of a notice from ACMA to produce information or to appear at a hearing or to subject yourself to an examination. And if you fail to comply with that notice in some way, Section 202 of the Broadcasting Services Act outlines that the penalty is 12 months imprisonment.
Thank you.
And, Senator, just to build up, it's actually a little bit worse than that as well, because I think it's Section 68 of the bill that's before the committee basically recognises that these proceedings can actually be initially at the behest of a request made by the minister. So you can have a situation where an Australian could end up in prison as a result of an original investigation undertaken by ACMA that was started by the relevant the communications minister. So that's, I mean, clearly that's something that's far, far away from where we should be as a democratic country.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just for the sake of clarity, I will just say that the bill expressly says that it does not include individuals. Expressly says that. And nobody's going to jail. So maybe it'll read of the bill and a read of the EM. We'll go.
You just need to read the bill and read the explanatory memorandum,
and they actually step it out for you quite clearly. We will now go to Senator Roberts.
No, we'll respond to that first.
No, we'll go to Senator Roberts.
Chair.
Let us respond to that.
Chair. Point of order. Yeah.
Okay.
I think the witnesses have the
right to reply.
Thank you,
Senator
Canavan.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I believe the provision...
But I will... Can I ask you to do that on notice? And the only reason I say that... Okay. All
this
right.
is how
go
it's going to work. This is how the laws will work in practice.
Go ahead.
It's fine.
I'm trying not to take
This is an
time,
insight into how these misinformation laws work.
People wanting to ask questions. Please. Mr Beck, Mr Wilde, please.
The point I understand that you're making is that Section 68 of the bill provides that the investigation is not to relate to particular content posted by a single end user.
Yep.
So that is easily circumvented by an investigation about a category of content or a type of content or the manner of content being published. And as a part of that investigation, ACMA would be entitled, under the provisions of the Broadcasting Services Act, to give notice to persons in order to aid in their investigation.
Exactly right.
So there you have it. And it's interesting that the chair tried to hose down the concept that actually individuals could be hit with a problem. But of course, if you read the detail of the bill, it's quite clear that it's there. Now, the second issue that Malcolm Roberts brought up was the fact that the bill in its changed incarnation this time around was significantly broader. And that, of course, begged a whole bunch of questions and raised some very important points as well.
I always have thought that the best arbiter of truth and the best arbiter of harm is free and open debate. Do you have any views?
Thanks, Senator. Yep, I would share that perspective. I'm also happy to tell you that Australians broadly share that perspective as well. I might just draw your attention to some polling that we recently did that I'm happy to provide to the committee. I can't remember if it was in our submission, but I'm happy to provide it. So basically what we asked in this question was, some people are concerned about the spread of information. Do you believe the best solution to countering misinformation is? Then we had a number of options: government censorship, more debate to counter false information, censorship by social media companies, more freedom of speech, or none of the above. Now, 49% said either more debate or more freedom of speech. Only 39% said government censorship or censorship by social media companies. So there's a decent size of Australians that believe that, well, we're going to have misinformation, there'll be false content online, but the best way to do that is to have more debate and more speech to counter that. The best fact checkers are the Australian people, not a government bureaucracy. The other point, Senator, that I think you'll find particularly interesting is that young Australians are the most strongly in favour of freedom of speech, and they thoroughly reject censorship. Only 8% of those aged 18 to 24 said they want government censorship to stop misinformation. Only 8%, and only 17% said they want to have censorship by social media companies. 59% said they want more debate and more freedom of speech. So that's the highest out of any age category. So there's a lot of, I guess, you know, concerns about the next generation coming through. We hear a lot about them, but the reality is that they are thoroughly opposed to this censorship regime that's been put before them.
Sorry, could I just... Sorry.
Open debate also develops responsibility amongst those who speak and those who challenge the what is said. So I think that's fundamental, because that responsibility is critical to a free and open society and a progressive society, by the real meaning of the word progressive. In the submission, you state the revisions made to the bill between the exposure draft and this draft have potentially broadened censorship concerns. Is that fairly representative of what you said?
Yeah, that's right. We were concerned about the definition of serious harm that had been amended from the exposure draft released last year. And one of the categories that stood out to us was the serious harm that was listed changing from hatred against a group to vilification. And the IPA has a body of research which has explained that vilification as a concept is fundamentally vague and subjective. And it seems like, you know, looking across most definitions, that the meaning of vilify, for instance, is broader than the meaning of hatred or hateful.
And then there was a deep discussion about the fact checkers and who pays who and how objective they are. This, for me, is a really important issue. And anybody who argues that the fact-checking process currently is working well, I think, is frankly deluded.
The definition of misinformation as content that is verifiable as false, misleading, or deceptive will empower politically and ideologically biased fact-checkers to decide which opinions are allowed on social media. My belief is the bill will force social media companies to pay good money to fact-checkers whose funding is not transparent, and in your submission you found that, quote, previous research by the IPA into Australia's three largest third-party fact-checking organisations, AAP Fact-Check, RMIT Fact-Lab, RMIT ABC Fact-Check, found that these entities exercise consistent bias in how they deal with political matters relating to major public policy debates. Does this bill now put truth in the hands of liars?
Well, what it certainly does do, Senator, is it empowers the fact checkers. So I think I mentioned before the research we did that found that 91% of fact checking claims made by those three organisations that you mentioned targeted the no case during the referendum.
Yep.
It does empower those fact checkers under clauses 33 and 34. I am aware that there are financial arrangements between the social media companies and fact-checking organisations. I don't know the details of that, but clearly they're going to be looking for business. So as we mentioned in our submission, that's an area of deep concern, that basically you've got the government outsourcing censorship to social media companies who will then probably outsource it to fact-checking organisations who have been proven and demonstrated to be politically biased.
And I think, Senator, in my view, the true dishonesty is in these fact-checkers holding themselves out as being adjudicators, that they have some sort of special command of the truth. In a healthy and free society, open debate means participants in the debate putting forward their arguments in order to see who's the most persuasive. The fact checker comes in and holds themselves out as the arbiter to decide which side is correct, but they're actually participants in the debate too. That's the reality. And as our research shows, and across a variety of a range of public policy areas, they exercise this immense bias and favouritism towards particular policy perspectives. That's the reality of them. It's a fundamentally dishonest arrangement.
Matt Canavan raised a very significant issue too, and that is, does this bill essentially allow a back door to open and to influence the debate in Australia from overseas sources? How does that work?
I'm a little concerned that this bill actually provides a back door for foreign governments to influence political communication in this country. The social media companies that will be required to establish internal censorship regimes are all pretty much foreign-owned. And we've seen in recent years with the disclosure of the Twitter files, I think there's been some similar Facebook files gone through Congress recently, that some of these organisations have been compromised by elements of the US government. And of course, we have another social media company called TikTok, where there's serious allegations of their the influence of the Chinese government over their algorithms. I mean, are you concerned that by this law being set up, the companies have to establish a misinformation, disinformation regime, and that regime, the terms of that regime, may be influenced by foreign governments, whether friends like the US, but still a foreign government, and or ones that aren't so friendly, like the Chinese Communist Party.
That's a good question. I haven't thought about it that
deep. As you say now, I think that's completely right. We're giving a lot of trust to digital platforms under this legislation, who, as you mentioned, generally sort of foreign-owned multinational corporations, to moderate and remove content by Australians. It's quite an extraordinary situation, and I think, as you've explained it just then, really reveals how absurd it is.
And it's also worth highlighting what Jarrett Rannoch was pushing at, which is that the penalty on social media companies are very severe, which means that they are going to be extremely proactive and will, well, frankly, silence people.
Look, I mean, yes. I guess the point is that the penalty is very severe. And as a result of the threat just of that penalty, I suspect the digital platforms aren't going to have the resources to monitor every person's post. So therefore, they're just going to take a blanket policy that any particular dodgy or sensitive topic, they're just going to take a blanket approach and censor anyone that dares question the government narrative or may, you know, just question the government narrative. Given the accuracy, because I know before you mentioned the bias of fact-checkers, but there's also a question over the accuracy of fact-checkers, even on the facts themselves. I mean, I've had memes that have been censored that were for a different topic. So when you actually read the fact-check, for example, the fact-check's not even related to the meme. So their own programs can't fact-check properly, number one. And number two, when you go and you try and contact the company, you can't contact the company. So, but I guess my question to you is, do you agree that the threat of the fine is going to put the arbiters of truth into the hands of these faceless fact checkers?
Certainly, yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, the issue that you've got is, and I understand why there's people concerned about false content online. I mean, there's just a plethora of, I mean, it's incalculable, you know, the amount of information that's online, and some of it's going to be false and some of it's going to be deliberately false with the intention of misleading people. I mean, that's an unfortunate reality, and I wish it wasn't the case, and we all do, but we have to live in the reality that if you're going to impose these very draconian requirements on social media companies. And you might, I don't know if there's anyone from the social media companies coming to these hearings, you might have to ask them about their mechanisms because I don't know the details of it. But just like we see in any other area of life, the regulation is always going to be, well, what is the least cost way of us achieving the outcome to avoid getting a fine or being punished by government? And so we see that across all areas of society. I don't see why it would be any different here. So that's why I say, and I want to emphasise the point, that it's really important that we have more open debate and freedom of speech online, because the only way to counter bad information is with other information and debate. So this is taking us down. We've got a choice as a society. Are we going to have a more open online world where we empower people with responsibility to say, look, there are going to be things online that are false. We want to equip you with the capacity to engage with that debate and access information. Or are we going to go down the path of trying to empower governmental bodies and quasi-government bodies to shut down the scope of the internet? And I think we have to go down the path of keeping it open.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, and that's right. Like, the threat will actually just enforce censorship because they just don't have the technical capacity. But you mentioned a good term before, the two-tiered system.
Yep.
And I think that's very relevant because a lot of these edgier posts that may be skirting, inverted commas, misinformation, disinformation, they don't really have much of a reach. Whereas on the other hand, mainstream media has a massive reach, and yet they're not being subjected to the same threats and penalties and overreach as what the digital companies are. And in many respects, it's the companies with the larger projection of power that should have greater oversight, in my view, because at least online you have the ability. If you think someone's spreading disinformation, you can put a post up there and say, well, look, that's still, you know, I disagree. I mean, some people may block you, but a lot of the time, you know, if it's getting any sort of, you know, virality in terms of getting across the internet, you won't be able to monitor the comments anyway. Whereas with the mainstream media, there's no feedback mechanism to push back on the newsreader at 6 o'clock or not and say, no, that's wrong. At least the digital companies, you know, you have a comments box where you can push back and go, that's no wrong, that's wrong, and you actually have open dialogue. So I guess I agree with your point about it's a two-tier system in regards to this.
And that led on to a conversation about whether, in fact, this bill was even trying to address the right issue, not least, of course, because with the rise of bots, well, the game has changed.
So how do you reconcile if bots don't have rights to proliferate, to have freedom of speech, and their platforms enable them to have a whole lot of misinformation spread by bots under perhaps the guise of free speech, they can basically do it without any impunity, so, or oversight from the government. How do you reconcile those two things? Like, how do we address the problem that we're trying to address if you've identified it clearly is a big problem for us?
So I think first thing I would say to that is you don't address it in the way that this bill attempts to address it. Our concern with this legislation is the effect it will have on people, on the Australian people. I think there's a very good debate and there's a very good discussion to be had about the right or proper role of government in dealing with things like bots on social media. But I think that's a matter for separate legislation for to be given its own consideration and not as something to be folded into this legislation, which is primarily concerned with censoring all content.
The other point, Senator, I'll just make is it's a bit tricky because, you know, where if you set up, say you're a person and you set up an account to have some kind of automated dissemination of material, well, at the end of the day, that's you doing it. So where there's a debate to be had about where does the sort of the human end and the bot begin? Because if you set something up as a person, then you should be protected to do that. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, heavily automated processes, then, you know, maybe you cross the line. But I don't think it's just as simple as saying, well, there's a bot, so it should be gotten rid of, because somewhere along the line, a human may have set that up. You know, if you send out an automated email, you haven't actually hit send yourself. It's sort of automated and sent down. And that's not a bot. That's a human effectively setting up a automated process. So you've just got to be careful about where the line is there.
Certainly, but there are bots and there are bots in terms of who's pushing this information out and large foreign governments and other actors are quite different to, you know, an individual Australian citizen and what they might put out, I think.
Then, of course, there was a discussion about the nature of serious harm, what that means, how it's measured. And once again, it touched on the whole question of whether this bill actually was tackling the right issue at all.
Thank you, Chair. I might start with Digital Rights Watch. I believe in your submission you've outlined that you continue to have concerns about the broad nature of how serious harm is defined in the proposed bill. Could you just outline what your concerns are in terms of their broad definition?
Yes, thank you, Senator, for the question. So the definition of serious harm still includes imminent harm to the Australian economy. I may be expressing the exact wording incorrectly, so forgive me. But that remains a concern for us, and we don't think that aligns with international human rights law and best practice, because, of course, we understand that freedom of speech is a right, but that it's appropriate to at times impose limitations on that right, but it has to be necessary and proportionate. And there is a body of law through various mechanisms in international settings that have built out what that right means and when the appropriate limitations apply. And in general, that has not included things like harm to the economy. So for that reason, we think that should be, the definition of serious harm should be narrowed, and that should not be a part of it.
You also, I think you mentioned also the leg of this stool which mentions the efficacy of preventative health measures. Do you think that's appropriate to be in the specific definition of serious harm?
I don't believe our submission made specific recommendations about what should or should not have been included in that definition at this stage of the drafting. What I would say is I think there is utility in thinking about public health initiatives coming from a place of trust, and in those circumstances, limitations of speech need to be considered in that context. So I think it warrants some careful consideration.
Just quote from your submission. Your submission says that we also note that certain kinds of public health initiatives can be contested. So with that in mind, how do you, would they be, do you think debate about public health measures should be moderated somehow by a government-enforced misinformation regime?
Well, what I would say, Senator, is that debates about public health are already moderated through a variety of different mechanisms. There are laws that limit speech in Australia that exist already. There are also algorithms that are developed by social media companies that are used to amplify certain kinds of content based on what is profitable for them. So that is a concern.
The distinction here is
it will be freedom of speech in Australia to begin with. Sure. But I think we may be in agreement here that we need a Human Rights Act that will create the right to freedom of speech, because that is the best way to protect it and ensure in legislative reforms that those considerations are taken into account.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. I mean, how would you define misinformation then?
I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, how would you define misinformation if you don't want it to be as broad as defined in this current bill?
I believe we were talking about serious harm rather than the definition of misinformation. I'm not sure that the definition of misinformation and disinformation is particularly problematic in this setting, but how serious harm is defined has to be carefully considered. So, I mean,
well, just to clarify, sorry to cut you off, but just to clarify my question, my understanding of how this bill operates is that it's only misinformation that causes or could cause serious harm that will be subject to censorship. So it's sort of linked to the definition,
practical definition
of misinformation. So I suppose I'll rephrase my question. How would you specifically identify or define in an Act of Parliament the kinds of misinformation that should be either banned or deprioritised on a social media platform?
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say about that question is I'm not sure it necessarily results in banning or deprioritisation. So I'd query that as a consequence of including certain criteria in the definition of serious harm. If I was to take a drafting pen and start this process from scratch, I would be importing human rights considerations into the test of what constitutes serious harm. So considering a balancing exercise between what the content is that might give rise to serious harm and what kind of infringements on human rights, including the right to freedom of speech, but other rights as well, might be impacted by defining certain kinds of content as serious harm. So it may not be that you have to just include a list in order to create a definition of serious harm that would work within this architecture. And I think there is the capacity to introduce human rights considerations that might improve the definition of serious harm and improve the processes for developing codes for moderating content.
I mean, the bill does, I think, take a cursory attempt, but it does seek to say that any misinformation frameworks should not impinge on the constitutional protections that the High Court has found around political discussion in Australia. And I see the witnesses here nodding their heads, so if you'd like to add to my questions, feel free to. I'm just starting as with the Digital Rights Watch submission. Do you think that you don't? By the sounds of it, you don't think those provisions adequately protect the human right to free speech?
To the implied right of freedom of political communication, which is contained in the Constitution, which I believe is what you're talking about, is manifestly inadequate, in my opinion, right, for the protection of speech from a human rights perspective. We fall far short of most other comparable liberal democracies around the world in not having those protections in place. So it is not enough currently that we only have access to an implied right within the Constitution. We absolutely need a Human Rights Act that gives proper protection for all human rights, including freedom of speech.
And that last point, we absolutely need a Human Rights Act, is, I think, a very important issue. Again, it really highlights to me that the whole concept and foundation of this bill is misplaced. But there are also bigger issues that should be addressed. And as Malcolm Roberts also highlighted, fact-checking is not simple. Can you prove something is true, or can you prove something is false? And how do you do that? And again, are fact-checkers essentially motivated by issues beyond truth? And to that extent, can we believe what they're saying?
You know, some people say, when I put out a post on social media, and I know it to be truthful, for a fact, and the fact checker comes along and says, this is rubbish, you'll go and look somewhere else. People respond to my post by saying, we know it's true now because the fact checker said it's not true. So, I mean, how do we, the fact checkers are ridiculed, there's no trust in fact checkers. How can we put trust in fact checkers now when the public have lost trust?
I think that the trust part of the equation is really, really important, and that's part of the misinformation and disinformation campaigns that are out there, is that they're designed to sow trust. It's not actually about proving anything anyway. As one of my members said to me, it's just like it's much harder to prove that something is false than it is to just keep repeating the falsehoods. And that's what's going on. We're seeing just a lot of stuff generated. It's very difficult to tell. It's interesting, I was having a quick look at the Digital Services Act in the European Union, which has a requirement that the digital giants have the ability for users to flag content that is illegal. So that might be terrorism related, and it might be other misinformation and disinformation, and that's connected at the moment. There's a case going on against the CEO of Telegram, which is not a public social media site as such. It's mostly private channels, but I guess when you've got enough people in them that becomes a public channel. So that's actually handing some power and agency to users to be able to flag content that they are concerned about, and the legislation there, I understand, it means the digital giants are required to respond. Once they've been notified, they have to respond. Now, whether that's a takedown or whether that's another investigation, but I think that's interesting. I'm not necessarily suggesting that is something that, you know, I don't know enough about it to be able to represent what it might mean to our legislation, but I think giving users agency to be able to say what is this and question is really important. But I think Senator Roberts, I think the problem is everybody's now sort of in their bunkers, if you like, right? And we now go looking for what we want to hear rather than, are open. And that's not just a media thing, that's a societal thing. We're actually all sitting there in our own little worlds. And I think that's a bigger issue than we're going to be able to address today. But it is something that is fundamentally why we have little faith in our media, we have little faith in our politicians, and we're starting to really doubt our public institutions, electoral commissions, health services and the like. And this is very, very dangerous, I think we can all agree. And the ABC, for example, now has a verify unit. AAP now has a fact check unit. So it is a bigger and important part of what they're doing. Now, what's interesting too is I think I read something recently that a lot of this fact check information doesn't actually change people's minds. That you're going looking for something, and if this is what you come across and you don't want to see it, you're not interested. But it is important from a public interest journalism front that that these things are put on the record by influential and verified and bona fide news organisations. So there is a public record of what is actually correct. But it would be that's the kind of thing that the news organisations would be able to tell you. Mm. Through COVID, and I was still a working day-to-day journalist then at the ABC, and the mess that was caused to our members and my colleagues when they were trying to put up verified, scientifically backed information, and just the deluge of misinformation and disinformation that they had to contend with. Similarly with The Voice. So, and you know, I think everybody's looking at what's going on in the American election and looking forward, you know, to next year in our election, and very concerned about what's going to happen here as well.
Mm. You referenced AI. What sort of impact is AI having on trust and integrity in that sort of general information flow environment?
Well, just as a high-level remark, people don't know what to trust. They don't know. People, journalists in the main, and one of the things I wanted to mention too is when it comes to media literacy, which is something this bill is looking at, it is fundamentally important that journalists be part of any drafting of what media literacy might look like. Our members, day in, day out, are having to detect this, having to deal with it, and they've got the tools, the strategies and the skills to be able to deal with it and recognise it. But I do think that you know, users would have to go in and have a look at a video and look at very closely. You know, our fact-check folks will go in and have a look at a video and say, well, that can't possibly be in Lebanon. It's actually Syria and it's back from then. That, you know, but you have to have the time and the inclination to do that. There are also, fake news websites that come up that look like, you know, it might be the Chicago News that actually looks like it might have a video with a watermark in the corner. It looks all very professional, but it's actually not got any, it started up in August 2024. It doesn't have a code of ethics. You don't know who's running it. You don't know who's funding it. So it's very difficult, and it's not reasonable to expect an ordinary user to go in and do all of that checking. And that's where the digital giants really need to be proactive. They need to, they know, they can tell surely when this is happening, when there's automated or, inauthentic behaviour. They can tell this kind of thing, and I think it's really important. It's unreasonable to put it back on users to be able to say, well, you should be able to detect that's fake, whether it's artificial intelligence or other kind of misinformation and disinformation. That's not reasonable.
And that last point about the fact that you can't put this all back on users to try and identify truth rather than not is quite an interesting one. I personally hold the view that we should let all the flowers bloom, and that people essentially can decide for themselves. Except, of course, the way the algorithms currently work, if you start going down a particular rabbit hole, then the algorithms pour more and more information into that same rabbit hole rather than not. So there is definitely a question here about the way social media works, but frankly, the misinformation and disinformation bill is completely misplaced in its attempt to try and solve one problem by effect creating another problem. And that problem, of course, is ultimately censorship. And the last clip here is actually a very important one. Who arbitrates as to who is a journalist and who is not, and who is speaking for the public interest and who is not? And this, to me, gets to the heart of the issue. This is why this bill should not be passed. This whole approach is so flawed as to be remarkable. And this takes us to a last point. If professional journalists have a particular role relative to everybody else, then who determines who is a professional journalist on what basis? And this takes us back to the fundamental point that information is much more widely available now, and there are many more people looking and analysing than previously because the information was less accessible before. So the internet is actually a good thing because it allows more access to more information. And I think it probably begs the question as to whether traditional journalism has such a critical role and such a distinctive role as now, and who plays the game. And that's why so many journalists seem to be protecting their own patch rather than entering into the broader debate.
Someone else's scenario who doesn't need to be a sitting member of parliament or a member of a political party, but that says, I adhere to the MEAA's ethical code, but you don't accept that they are a professional journalist. Ultimately, you're saying that the digital platforms would need to go to you and say, is this person a journalist? Is this person covered under your test of ethical public interest journalism? I'm just trying to understand who arbitrates who is engaged in ethical public interest journalism? Or is it ACMA? Or is it Google? Or is it Facebook?
Well, we certainly wouldn't want it to be Google or
no.
Facebook.
But do you want it to be the MEAA?
Ah, I think we'd probably have to take that on notice. We wouldn't have the resources to be able to do that. We wouldn't be the arbiters of that. But Matt might want to weigh in, but I think that's something that is definitely worth a discussion.
Okay.
On that exact same point, it was an interesting, and I am being a bit cheeky again, I acknowledge this. On that same point, if Senator Sharma's viewpoint of being a member of Parliament would, on the face of it, prima facie exclude him from being a journalist, wouldn't journalists have to disclose their membership and or affiliation to any other group, party or otherwise for risk of the same thing? Can a journalist be non-biased if they are a member of an organisation that has a certain view, given that that was the reason for exclusion of Senator Sharma?
So it's kind of a very, very specific hypothetical that I'm not sure is useful in this debate. But again, I would go back to the code of ethics. Is it independent? Independence is really, really important. If you can prove that you're independent, sure. If you can prove that, you know, you're engaging in fairness and honesty and respect for the rights of others, and then those 12 very reasonable steps within the code. So I think it's, I'm not sure it's helpful to go into such specifics, but in the main, accountability and transparency really is important for the credibility of journalists.
But I'm going back, if a member of yours is a member of the National Party, as am I, can they be independent without disclosing that?
Senator Cadella said, because we don't know people's affiliations, we don't know their leanings, and especially with the Australian Communication and Media Authority. So that's it puts enormous power in the hands of people we don't know their background.
The bottom line is this: the bill in its current form should be thrown out. And whilst there are some broader debates about freedom of speech and the way social media companies work, this approach is frankly a disaster. If it's accepted, it will lead to censorship. If it's accepted, ordinary people will no longer have a voice, whereas the politicians, the media companies and universities somehow are put up on an artificial pedestal to say what they want. This is not democracy. This is not freedom. And certainly this is not free speech. This bill must be rejected. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.